Welcome to Conversations with a Wounded Healer. I'm your host, Sarah Bueno. I'm a psychotherapist, teacher, consultant, and most importantly, a wounded healer, living and working in Chicago, Illinois.
And I'm your host, Anne Remy. I'm a counseling psychotherapist, yoga teacher, and trauma specialist living in Brighton, UK. On this show, we interview folks in a variety of healing professions, and we discuss the intersectional journey of healing self while caring for others.
But we're not just focused on individual healing, but also healing on the collective level, from white supremacy, late-stage capitalism, and the patriarchy. Thanks for joining us! Anne!
Hey, Sarah.
How many emotional support beverages do you have with you right now?
Two.
I have four. You're a slacker.
Well, it is 2 p.m, so usually there would be a third.
There you go.
But I kept it light today.
Okay. Yeah. That's fair. Yeah. It's a long time since I posted that, probably by the time this comes out, but I had posted something about emotional support beverages and you got a lot of play. It was pretty nice.
It's real. And so many people make fun of me because if I'm going to be a therapist somewhere, I unpack like 3 different bottles, one for my tea, one for my protein powder, one for my water. That's just what I do.
In the morning, I start with 4. Mm-hmm. So I have my smoothie. I have my chai latte. I have my regular water, which is boring and I hate, and it's the last thing that I drink. And then I have, I guess it's like electrolyte something in here.
Oh, my emotional support beverages get refilled multiple times.
Oh, yeah. I just don't, this is unimportant. We're going to stop talking about this.
Okay.
So before we started recording, I unfortunately filled you with existential dread. But other than that, how are you?
I'm great, other than the existential dread.
Yeah, I mean, same, right? And I'm guessing everybody listening has a significant amount of existential dread. I feel like the closer we get to November in the U.S., the more the existential dread will rise. But, you know, so I hope everybody's taking care of themselves with emotional support beverages and beyond.
And in the U.K., there's an upcoming election.
Yeah.
And Nigel Farage, the guy behind Brexit, has created his own new party, which is equivalent, how I'm explaining it to people, it's equivalent to like the Tea Party.
Fun.
We're not far off from like Make England Great Again.
Fun.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, and today's guest is living in England, also an American living in England. So,
she is. As soon as I heard that she's in the UK, I was like, can I find her? Can I meet her? Can I go to something that she's going to host?
I bet you can. Get on her email list. You should.
Yes, yes, yes.
Should we talk about how people can support the podcast first?
Sure.
That's a terrible segue. You're so much better at segues than I am. So first of all, we are about a month away from celebrating our anniversary with Anne's 1 full year of being co-host of Conversations with the Wounded Healer.
And you didn't fire me. Yay.
I didn't. And I don't plan to.
Yay.
So we're doing a giveaway where Anne is offering, what are you offering again?
A yoga session or help planning travel somethings.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then I am offering either a business coaching session or a Reiki session. So all you have to do is write us a review. And we now have a wonderful little URL you can go to, ratethispodcast.com/woundedhealer. If you go there, you can choose wherever your rating shows up. It's very exciting. I haven't used it yet. I haven't seen anyone post yet. But if you rate on there, still screenshot it and email it to me at sarah@headheartbiztherapy.com or shoot it to me on Instagram @headheartbiztherapy. And then you will be entered into the drawing to win an hour with Anne and an hour with me.
Yeah.
So that's one way. Mm-hmm. You can also buy merch at our merch store, tinyurl.com/CWH merch. Mm-hmm. And you can support us on Patreon for as little as $1 a month. It would be so lovely. And Anne and I have been having extra conversations where she and I just spend time together without guests. Mm-hmm. And I think we're gonna try to do some like therapy sessions on each other too, to like, you know, share different therapy modalities and talk about stuff and all sorts of things. So join us over there at patreon.com/convos with the wounded healer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
So let's talk about
Sarah McLachlan started playing in my head, as you said, for as little as a dollar a month.
In the arms of an angel. I won't go further so we don't get sued.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Focus.
Yes.
Focus. Lori Beth.
Lori Beth Bisbee. So before we even begin talking about her, I don't like trigger warnings because I think that we live in a world of triggers and we need to build the internal capacity to tolerate them. Yet, however, we do talk about a lot of potentially graphic things that may be disturbing to viewers. So take care of yourselves as you listen to this episode. But Anne, I didn't tell you that before you listened. What do you think? How'd it go for you?
Oh, fine. I was like, we definitely are going to have to put a content warning on this one.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Listen. So I usually listen to your episodes while I'm cooking or something. And it actually made me stop cooking because she was saying so many things that I was like, I need to write this down. I loved what she just said. So when she said she lived in the UK, I was like, what a joy for me. Yeah. How was it to interview her for you?
It was fine. And I say that because I was, like, I think I mentioned at the top of the episode, I was nervous because the last time I interviewed an expert on sex therapy, I got super duper triggered. It was like a really intense experience for me. I did not have that experience this time. So it was good. You know, as I was listening back to it, it's funny. Usually when I listen to my own episodes, I will have the same question when I listen to it the first time. And then I'm like, oh, yeah, well, I already said that. But this time I had different questions. So it's almost like there were other things that I wanted to come out that didn't come out. But it's okay. It is what it is. And it feels, to me, it feels like a bit of a different episode than the types of episodes we normally have. But it also feels really important because I do think that a lot of people have experience challenges with sex in relationship and either judging themselves or being harmed by others or, you know, whatever. I think it's so important to talk about a broad spectrum of sexuality. And I think Lori Beth does a beautiful job of that.
She did an amazing job of that. One of the things that I wrote down that she said was, I didn't know my body belonged to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, holy shit. Like, when she said that, I like paused it and I was like, oh my God. Like, it did not occur to me until I'm trying to think of when I actually realized that my body belonged to me.
Mm.
Probably, I actually couldn't tell you.
Mm.
And that is less, you know, I don't have the same shared like sexual abuse history. But so much of my sort of religious stuff was pinging while she was talking.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Because at no point when I was young did I feel like my body belonged to me because it belonged to Jesus or God or, and I wasn't allowed to make the decisions over what I did with it because there were all these rules for it. So there were so many, just so many things that she said that really made me like, whoa. And I think when we look at a lot of the stuff that she talks about and deals with, you start to hear the sort of Victorian morals that have been pushed onto society and how there's a lot of stuff, as long as everyone involved is able to consent, can consent, and is consenting, like who gets to make the rules?
The whole consent thing, I had forgotten that I wanted to bring this up because so I've been training with the Right Use of Power Institute to be a facilitator for them. And they're an amazing organization and talk about power in a way that I've never heard power talked about before. And one of the things that we're doing in the facilitator training is doing presentations for one another. And one of my colleagues, Cody Spiker, gave a presentation on consent. And I'm sure that this term is probably very well known for some people, but I had never heard it before. So the acronym is FRIES for consent. And so FRIES means freely given, reversible, informed, enthusiastic, and specific.
Oh, I've never heard that.
Right? Yeah, I'd never heard that before. And one of the things that I was curious about with this episode with Lori Beth is I believe that I mentioned I had a I had a relationship with someone where at the end of that relationship, it felt as if I had been sexually assaulted by this person, even though I thought everything was consensual. Mm-hmm. But when I use fries to take a look at the consent that I was providing, I was being coerced to do things. Mm-hmm. And I was being pressured and I was being shamed when I wasn't doing things that this person wanted me to do. And I was being told like I was doing polyamory wrong because I wasn't going for a gangbang when that's like not what I was ready for with strangers, right? So yeah, it was interesting because that's what I was afraid was going to be like triggered from this place that I didn't have any, I don't want to say control over, but didn't have any like agency within myself about. But it actually felt more empowering. And that's how I felt the first time that I listened to Lori Beth, was this more like, oh, it makes more sense why I felt that way after this relationship ended, now that I hear what she has to say.
And I'm really glad, and you'll hear her kind of talk about, because my brain went exactly to how much of women's consent is not fries consent.
Right.
And she talks about someone who asked her something similar and she got angry because it assumes that all hetero relationships, like a woman is, of course, like the, I forget the word she uses, but
submissive.
Like the bottom, the submissive. Thank you. And she addressed that and her answer gave me, I just liked everything she said. She was great.
Yeah. And I think sometimes, like in my experience, I thought I was giving full consent. And then later I realized I wasn't, because there was a part of me that I was denying. So it's complicated, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's complicated. So I don't think that it's for other people to decide what's consensual and non-consensual. I think it's for the person to decide.
Yeah.
Well, let's introduce Lori Beth.
Yeah.
Dr. Lori Beth Bisbee is a psychologist, accredited advanced GSRD, which stands for Gender, Sex, Relationship, Diversity Therapist, sex and intimacy coach, author, speaker, and TV personality, currently starring in Open House, The Great Sex Experiment, Channel 4 in the UK. She's been working with people for the past 35 years, helping them to create and sustain their ideal relationships, containing sizzling sex without shame. She has a weekly podcast, The A to Z of Sex, since 2016, and is currently touring the UK, speaking about kink, fetish, BDSM, and non-monogamy. So please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Lori Beth Bisbee. Hey there, therapist. How you doing? If you're like a lot of people out there, maybe you need a little bit more support than usual. Well, I've got you covered. I'm currently running two groups that I plan to run again in the fall of 2024. So add your name to the waitlist to be notified as soon as info is available. First is the Burnt Out Practice Owner Support Group for group therapy practice owners. We'll focus on the emotional component of business ownership while building trust and connection with other practice owners. We'll explore topics such as boundary setting, feeling underappreciated, overwork, and find ways to reconnect with our agency. And you'll also have the support of other practice owners when challenges arise within your business. Next is the Authentic Leaders Group. It's here to help you become the authentic and wholehearted leader you aspire to be. Join me on an 8-month journey of self-discovery and leadership mastery, where you'll enhance your leadership skills and forge meaningful connections with fellow therapists who are committed to their own growth and the betterment of the therapy field. For the Burnt Out Practice Owner waitlist, go to www.headheartbiztherapy.com/burntout. Make sure you've got the T in B-U-R-N-T-O-U-T. And next is the Authentic Leaders Group waitlist at www.headheartbiztherapy.com/authentic-leaders-group. Hope to see you soon. Hello, Lori Beth. Welcome to Conversations with a Wounded Healer.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited. And as I told you before we started recording, also a little trepidatious to be with you today because of my own history, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. You know, I've read your bio for listeners, but would you like to explain to folks more about who you are and what you do?
So I'm a psychologist and an accredited advanced gender, sex, and relationship diversity therapist. So that part of my work is my specialty in working with people who are LGBTQ involved in alternative relationships like kink, BDSM, or non-monogamy. And I also have a specialty in trauma. I do a lot of speaking And I've been on a television show the last couple of years called Open House, The Great Sex Experiment, as the resident therapist. And I write. And my involvement in this area came from my own life experience, which is not unusual for psychologists or therapists. I mean, oftentimes people go into training because they've experienced something, or they've experienced something and then they go and they get therapy and then they go into training.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what the podcast is all about. So I found you through, it's Laid Open Podcast, I believe.
Yes.
Is the name, right? Yeah. And it was interesting because, is it Sharna?
Yeah.
We were talking about something on Facebook. She had posted about the Danny Masterson case and sort of the ins and outs of consent. And it was very nuanced the way that she had wrote everything. And I thanked her for attending to it with such nuance. And she's like, oh, if you want to hear more about consent and all of that, you need to listen to this episode. And so I was going into it literally thinking I was going to learn just more salacious details about this Danny Masterson situation, just as a voyeur.
Oh,
right.
Oh, God.
And that is not what happened. But what happened was really important medicine for me, I think, in hearing some of the things that you shared in that episode. And I reached out to you immediately wanting to share space with you as well. So all that being said, I guess first question is just your therapist origin story. What led you to become a psychologist?
Well, so my origin story starts in different places these days. Mm. I mean, I was 9 when I knew that I was different sexual orientation. And so I felt different. I was different. Mm. I identified that power was the thing that turned me on. And so those were the relationships I pursued from the very first bits of puberty. And I originally went to university to study broadcast journalism. I liked being in front of a camera. I liked being on stage. I acted. I also love to write. So that's where I was going. And I was introduced to a man during my sophomore year of university by a really close friend and entered into what I thought was a consensual BDSM relationship with him. Mm-hmm. And 2 weeks into the relationship, he took me prisoner and held me for 5 days. And I know, I'm sure you're going to trigger warning this, so I just say it how it is.
Yeah.
So he repeatedly raped me, he beat me, and at one point he killed me, and I came back to life with him giving me CPR. I imagine he hadn't intended on doing that, and he realized the consequences. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, I got PTSD, not surprisingly.
Right.
But my PTSD was quite complicated because I had the desires before the experience, and I had the desires after the experience.
Right.
And so I then had to make sense of how I managed my desires in light of what had happened. So obviously, initially, I thought that this was something that was my fault, which is also not unusual, particularly because a lot of people have orgasm during rape and assault, and that's because our bodies go and do what our bodies do.
Right.
There's a wonderful term for it. It's arousal non-concordance, which is when your body responds sexually, but you are subjectively not aroused. Mm-hmm. It could also be the other way. You could be subjectively aroused and your body doesn't respond.
Right.
So it's when they don't match up. And for that reason, rape and sexual assault victims of all genders can find themselves really believing that they have caused this and they're horrible people because they enjoyed what happened. And it gets more nuanced from there. I wrote my erotic memoir in 2020. I've just released the second edition, which is on my website, but not yet on Amazon. The first edition is still on Amazon. And one of the things that I deal with in that is the different threads, the things that are still a turn on, even though they came from that, the things that predated that, and all the different aspects of pulling those threads of healing apart. So I went into therapy immediately because I wasn't functional initially, and became functional walking wounded, which is typical also of PTSD. Pretty quickly, and switched my study right then. And so I pursued, for administrative reasons, I pursued a bachelor's in special education with a psychology minor. And then I went on to graduate school, got a master's and a PhD. And my PhD research was treatment outcome research for post-traumatic stress disorder, comparing a couple of techniques with a control group, because I had successful treatment in 1989. Yes,
wow.
1989. And I haven't had symptoms since. So there are other aspects of healing. So I haven't had PTSD since, but kind of making more sense of choosing healthy relationships took longer, took significantly longer. And I, you know, when I talk about it, I talk a lot about the different layers that people have, and that some things are very good for talk therapy, and other things you sort of initially have to be doing and see a pattern. And so coaching works better, and other things, body work might work better. And that it just becomes this long process. First, the process of healing, and then the process of personal growth layered on top of that.
Mm-hmm. I really, really appreciate you sharing your story so candidly, because I think, you know, I found therapists are fearful people and sometimes fear sharing their own stories. But I think that that's how we heal, and that's how we do the work that we do, right? If we haven't experienced struggle, then how do we know how to help others?
Well, I mean, there are people who don't experience struggle and at that level.
At that level, yeah.
Or at a deep level, or at a deep level even. Right. And they go on and help others with other things. Mm-hmm. And some people also still specialize in trauma, having not really experienced much diagnosable trauma. And I make that distinction, right?
Yes.
Everybody experiences trauma.
Exactly.
And some people will go and work with people and they'll still be somewhat successful at it. I think for me, my models in psychotherapy were people like Irvin Yalom, who is an existentialist who is very clear about you being a real human being in the room.
Yeah.
Which doesn't mean you sit and tell your whole story to your client, but it means that you have real reactions, and it does mean that people know things about you.
Yeah.
So when I started working with people, when I work with people in certain ways, they'll know less about me. But these days, I don't work that way anymore because I'm too well known. And so people know, they come to me because they know things about me. And stuff is on the website. And eventually, like I said, I put out this erotic memoir, which initially was really frightening to do.
Mm-hmm.
Writing it was something I knew I was going to do. But actually deciding to do it as an erotic memoir, so it's got a piece of erotica, and then a piece of my story, and then some analysis.
Mm-hmm.
So it's erotica I've written. So it actually tells people far more about me than it would have been if I'd just written kind of a standard memoir. But it really works. And it's really, I mean, it's provocative. One of my partners, like, it took her 6 months to actually read it because she knows me. And so when she got to the places where horror occurred, to actually get through that was so difficult for her.
Mm.
Whereas with a stranger, she would have had an easier time.
Right.
I have people, I give trigger warnings in the beginning. I tell people, you know, you might not want to read this bit if you've had these things. It was very exposing to put that out. But I do think it's really important because the message a lot of people get is that you can't get better.
Right.
You can go from victim to survivor, but that's as far as you're going to go.
Mm.
And it's bullshit. Mm. It's bullshit.
What would you put after survivor?
Thriving life.
Thriver.
And so the reason I can tell that story and, you know, and I'm not in floods of tears and I'm not shaking is because that's not live. Those memories are no longer live. They are part of my past. They're significant. I don't downplay them. I don't minimize them. Mm. I don't wish they never happened. But they're not live.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people will tell me, oh, I've dealt with my trauma. And then they'll say something. They'll start talking about it. They're in floods of tears.
Right.
I'm like, it's not dealt with yet. And then they get angry. I said, no, listen, honey, if you are crying, if you can be triggered by something, if you're angry, anytime you're triggered by something, that's live. It means it's still in the present with you. There's no judgment on that. It's just, it's a fact. So understanding that when it's live, you can be triggered. And when it's no longer live, when it's part of your past, you can't. And there are ways to work with people that will help them get to where it's no longer live.
Right.
But the message still, I think, in the world is that that doesn't happen.
Yeah. And I mean, I can also share from my own experience, too, the judgment of our body for continuing to respond to triggers, and wanting to, quote unquote, be normal. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've said to my therapist, like, when will I XYZ again? When will I feel the way that I thought I felt before? And it's just sexual trauma does not heal on a linear timeline.
No, it doesn't. But it can heal a lot faster than you think.
Mm.
It's about having the right methods to work and being ready to confront it. And those are two different things.
Yeah. Talk about the second one, because I have thoughts on that, but I want to hear what you have to say.
So there are some really effective methods of treating trauma that are still quite different than other therapy. Fine. They're not actually that different. It's just that anything that doesn't use a 50-minute hour freaks people out, right?
Yeah.
And they work really, really well. But in order to make them work, you have to be able to say everything that comes to mind. You have to be able to not hold anything back. And that's because you put your energy and your attention on what you're holding back. So you're not entering fully into the process. So in order to do that, you have to trust the therapist and their motivation and that you will get through it and be feeling better.
And trust your, trust yourself.
That's it. That you can do it. You're going to make it. Right. You're not going to die. You won't get stuck there. You will come out the other side. So that can take time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For people to be able to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had like 8 years of therapy before I had the stuff that really worked.
Thank you for sharing that timeline. Yeah.
Well, I mean, this was serious. Mm-hmm. You know, there were other traumas in my history that, of course, ended up triggered as a result of this huge one. But this was serious shit.
Yeah.
Therapists couldn't deal with hearing about it. So that was the other problem that I had.
Right.
When I talked about the things that he did that people got, you could see that they were shocked or nauseated or upset. And so, I mean, that's the other part of it is trying to talk to somebody who's registering on their face how shocked, nauseated, upset, angry they are.
Right.
It's not helpful.
Right.
It just stops you. You start looking after the therapist instead of being held in your process. So I do believe that it's important for people, particularly people who've done no therapeutic work whatsoever, may even feel like therapy is a stigmatizing thing and you shouldn't need therapy and may not understand what therapy is as well, actually go through the process of getting to trust and know someone. And I think I find with clients that sexual trauma in particular makes that harder. And sexual trauma at a young age, so by young age, I mean up to the age of about 22, 23, right? Makes that even more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Actually trusting another human being with yourself, with all of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't often talk about that as part of the healing. So the timeline is heavily influenced by your ability to engage. It's also influenced by finding the right therapy, the right kinds of therapy, you know, really being willing to confront the bits that you're ashamed of, that you feel horrible about, that you judge yourself about. It's not really, people, you know, worry this much about the judgment from others, a tiny amount, but they end up doing is judging themselves.
Right.
So that it can take a long time. But the other thing that you said that really struck me is, you know, when am I going to feel such and such a way again? You're not. You're never going to feel that way again.
Exactly.
You're not the same person.
Right.
And like in my case, I was 19 years old. And up until that time, even though I'd had some childhood trauma, it wasn't catastrophic. I mean, if I start talking about it, people are like, oh my God, but it wasn't catastrophic. I didn't have PTSD. What I had was, I was brought up in a situation where boundaries were a bit fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
So I did not know that my body belonged to me. So that was problematic. That was really problematic.
Mm-hmm.
And that got me into difficulty because I wasn't going to set a boundary as quickly as somebody else was. I didn't recognize when somebody was being inappropriate as quickly. So, you know, I had earlier things that were smaller. They weren't, you know, they didn't give me symptoms. I didn't have nightmares, you know, none of that. But in order to be able to deal with this catastrophic level of stuff, you have to kind of understand that you can make it out of it.
Right.
And that's not a given.
Right.
That's not a given. I mean, people think, the reality is people don't get stuck in their trauma. Can I say that? Really?
Yeah, say more.
People don't get stuck there. They think they're going to get stuck there. They think they're going to start crying and never stop.
Right.
They don't. But you're not going to become another, back to that person. So because my trauma was so early, I was still in that la, 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 nothing can touch me bubble, the narcissistic bubble. Most of us, I'm going to qualify this. There are plenty of places in the world where people don't have the luxury of that narcissistic bubble growing up.
Mm-hmm.
There are plenty of places in the Western world where that's the case.
Yeah.
But if you are not brought, well, and I'm sure it's very different these days. I'm going to say this. I'm older. I'm 60. When I was growing up, people weren't shooting people up in schools every day. That wasn't what was happening.
Right.
And so we actually grew up with the belief that we couldn't be touched.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right. Or that you would know, right? That,
right.
Like for me, I was grew up in the 80s and 90s. I'm 44.
Right.
So stranger danger, right? Like don't get in the van with the man with candy, right?
Right. Well, we were told that as well. But we also, you still grew up with the belief that We didn't live in fear. Mm-hmm. We didn't live in fear. I mean, you know, generation before me lived in fear of the bomb dropping on them, but still,
right.
But there was still a sense of otherness about it.
Yeah.
Even though you would do the drills, there was a sense of otherness about it. It was like a fantasy. And these sorts of things did not happen to you. If you did the things your mother told you, your father told you, you would be okay.
Right.
But once you've seen that the world is actually not a safe place, you can't unsee that.
Yeah.
And so then you have to figure out how to survive in this not safe place when you're now more at risk because you're not totally in the present.
Right.
And I got criticized yesterday for saying that. Somebody's like, oh, you're victim blaming. I said, no, I'm not. I'm talking facts about predators.
Right.
Predators pick on the weak ones.
Exactly.
That's what they do.
Vulnerable. Studies have shown that for years.
Yeah. I'm like, I remember you have a 25% higher chance of experiencing another sexual assault if you've been sexual assaulted.
Right. Right. Yep.
Sexually assaulted. I mean, it's amazing. But what I think it is are two things. One is that you're not fully present because you keep getting triggered.
Yeah.
So you're in the past, you're not fully present. So you're not fully aware of your environment. And so if somebody is looking, even if it's somebody who knows you looking to coerce, even if it's not a stranger, somebody's looking to coerce, it's easier to coerce somebody who's not fully there.
Yeah.
You know, so you are more vulnerable from that.
Mm-hmm.
And the other part of it is that most people who have been through this don't set good boundaries.
Right. Right.
If they didn't have a problem with it before, they do afterwards. And so it's like you have a sign on your forehead that's blinking that says, you know, I'm the weak one.
Yep.
Prey is over here.
Totally.
So, you know, I think it's when you've come through it like that, understanding what the process is going to be, you're never going to be that person that you were. That innocence is never coming back.
Right.
We're looking to construct who are you going to be in the future?
Yeah.
Who do you want to be?
Yeah. It's really interesting, too, because I'm polyamorous and I had a romantic relationship that sort of triggered this awakening of, oh, my God, I'm a sexual abuse survivor. And it's been 7 years since then. And I've watched myself try to reconnect to what one of my therapists had said to me was, you had constructed a false sexuality based on the protection that you needed as a child. And now you have an opportunity to build one that's more authentic to who you really are. And I've watched myself now date other people and feel the experience of, I can feel the difference of coming into a date now with my full embodied self and staying connected to that. Whereas initially before, I was giving away my power, not in a like consensual way, but in just a need for validation, a need for some sort of connection. And I think you called it like the edge. I was looking for someone to meet my edge. I've always called it my darkness, needing a partner to really meet me in that dark place. And that's one way like I've sort of been able to check my healing process is I have more agency now in these interactions than I did before.
And I mean, and so the agency is the really important bits. I was doing a talk last night and a sociology student asked whether or not we really needed, I don't know, if I wish I could remember exactly the way I said it, but it was whether or not we really needed to look at male dominant, female submissive relationships in relation to our culture and see that, you know, essentially they aren't healthy and that we, you know, we needed to really consider that because they're enacting, you know, the oppression that's outside. And I was furious.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, it's always so interesting to me that people will talk about female dominant, female submissive relationships, female dominant, male submissive relationships, and male male relationships, and about how they can be so empowering. But when it comes down to male dominant, female submissive relationships, we believe that the women can't possibly have agency because the culture demonstrates an unhealthy version of that.
Right. Right.
And I'm like, so what makes you think that those of us who engage in this, and I have both male and female partners, so. And like, what makes you think that those of us who engage in this are incapable of doing the work to understand the external oppression, are incapable of separating ourselves from that and don't have the agency to make decisions for ourselves and actually construct a relationship that rather than being oppressing is a way of mastering some of
that? Yes. Preach. Exactly.
I get so offended by this rhetoric that keeps going and going and going. Well, these relationships can be abusive. All relationships can be abusive.
Exactly. Yeah.
And actually, it isn't hard to spot the ones that are abusive. Even the ones that are engaging in consensual non-consent, where people are in really restrictive relationships because that's what they want. Mm-hmm. It is actually so easy, if you understand abuse, to spot where the abuse is, as long as you don't have bias. Mm-hmm. You have to not have bias.
Right.
And there's a ton of bias out there.
Yeah.
An absolute ton of bias. The rhetoric about the feminist rhetoric now, again, is back on this thing about, you know, all pornography and violent pornography causes all our problems, and all pornography is inherently debasing to women. And you know, I mean, it's not, so there are some people who are more nuanced, but a lot of the rhetoric isn't nuanced.
Mm-hmm, right.
And dismissive of, again, any kind of BDSM relationship where it's a man on top and a woman on the bottom.
Yeah.
It's bizarre to me. Like, why would we want to stigmatize it further? How will that help?
Right. Do you know what's just around the corner? It's Anne's anniversary, being part of Conversations with a Wounded Healer. And we are celebrating the anniversary with a giveaway for anybody who wants to write an Apple Podcast review between March 6th and April 24th of 2024. So go to Apple Podcast, whether it's on your phone or your laptop, search for Conversations with a Wounded Healer, click on the show and scroll down until you see ratings and reviews. Tap write a review and tell us what you think about the show. Then you'll screenshot your review and email it to me at sarah@headheartbiztherapy.com. Now, I know you're thinking, what are the giveaways already? Well, very exciting. You will be entered into a drawing to win 1 hour sessions with both Anne and me. Anne will give you a choice between a private yoga class or a travel consultation session. And with me, you can choose between a 1 hour business coaching session or a Reiki session. Submissions must be received by 11:59 p.m. Central Standard Time on April 24th. The winner will be announced on social media on May 1st, and Anne and myself will reach out to you to schedule your sessions. So please enjoy our anniversary giveaway and celebrate our little Anne Remy. Well, and I'm curious, too, to have you talk a little bit more about, on the Late Open podcast, you said that, because I think the common belief is that if you are into kink, then something happened to you as a child, and that's part of, you know, why you act out your kinks. I'd love to hear from you about both sides, right? I don't know. I guess I have assumptions for myself that my kinks do come from being abused, but maybe they don't, and I'd love to hear more about it.
I think the thing is that people have to understand is that it's nuanced and it's really individualistic.
Yeah.
The idea that it's like 50 Shades of Grey, which is that big myth, right? Like the reason people do these things, whether they're on the bottom or on the top, is because they were, you know, abused in childhood, and either it was put into their sexual map because of the abuse, or control became a thing so that they would never be hurt again.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the blanket reason that people have kinks. You know, we don't have good research as to why. There are so many different whys. But one thing we do know is that it seems, the anecdotal evidence is that this runs in families like LGBTQ does, that all of these differences.
Ooh.
And so it's been, it's been really interesting tracing with people that I know, the people in their family, and that, you know, when they go back generations, oh, well, now I understand that behavior. Now I know what that hook was for, right? And it's just, it's fascinating that people find it, but we actually don't know. Now, what we can say is that for some people, certainly their trauma can lead to their kink in a variety of ways. For some, there's a really intense sensory connection made, right? Because like we said earlier, arousal non-concordance, you have an orgasm whether you want to or not in certain circumstances like that.
Right.
So for some, there's a really intense connection. And the example that I like to use is Six of the Best, because I live in the United Kingdom. So Six of the Best, you know, it was common in schools and parents, discipline was with a cane and you got six. If you did wrong, they gave you six of the best. The headmaster or the teacher or your parent would hit you with a cane six times, six stripes. Right. And there's a lot of people where that was sexualized because during adolescence, when this was happening, you know, I say do it for male-bodied people. It's easier because random erections are a thing, right? And when a random erection is paired with a sensation, the assumption is this is a turn-on. So it can be, because of that. It can be in part because of the abuse.
Mm-hmm.
But for a lot of people, it just isn't. They were kinky before the abuse.
Hmm.
Then they got abused.
Yeah.
Now it just became more complicated.
Right. Well, and for those of us who experienced early childhood sexual abuse, right, it's like it's hard to say because a four-year-old isn't, I mean, they are sexual beings, but not really consciously, I guess, in touch with that as an adult would be.
Well, they don't interpret.
Right.
They don't interpret. They have feelings in their body that are pleasurable. That is the way in which they're sexual beings.
Right.
And actually, at that age, a lot of the things that kids do that are pleasurable, they use to self-soothe.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But they don't have an adult framework.
Right.
They don't have a cognitive framework to make sense of it. But what that means is when you're talking about early childhood abuse is that you can get a lot of weirdly sexualized things that get taken into the adult sexual map because your body is doing what it's doing. And because early childhood, you don't have shame-based mm-hmm. stuff, right? That doesn't usually come in without a parent actively sort of inculcating it. And it's not really strong until 5, 6 years old when kids start to get what conscience is, right?
Mm-hmm.
At 3, 4 years old, you don't have that.
Mm.
So it just becomes part of your sexual map.
Mm.
And there it is.
Mm.
So that brings its own issues. So I think, you know, in answer to the question, it can be, and it also often isn't.
Mm-hmm.
There's two reasons that people want to know if that's the case, if this is how you develop kink. One is because they really don't want to be kinky, right? Because they don't feel normal, and they'd like this to stop. And particularly if it reminds them of abuse, they'd like this to stop. So their hope is if we can figure out in therapy exactly where that is, it will go away. I won't work with people to try and make a kink go away because it's
useless. Just like conversion therapy for
exactly what it is.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it is. And so even if we're not successful at shit like that.
Right.
We're fucking awful at shit like that. We're awful at trying to change things that produce visceral pleasure.
Right.
And immediate reward. So it's stupid to go on that path because you're absolutely going to fail. So let's not go there.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's one of the places that people go is they want to change this. The other place is the opposite, which is they're kinky. And now they're afraid if they get rid of their trauma and they get rid of their PTSD, that their kink will go away.
Oh, interesting.
And it usually doesn't.
Mm. Well, I guess that's sort of one way you can tell whether it was the cause of the kink or not.
Even when it was the cause, it usually doesn't.
Wow.
The pleasure response is so intense to get rid of that isn't easy. So sometimes it will change. I don't think I've actually, in 36 years, ever had a client where it disappeared. I know other people who have, but not many. I've had it change. I've had people not like certain things that they've always liked before.
Mm.
And the kind of kink moved, right? But they were still kinky. They just weren't that kind of kinky.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So they either come in afraid that it won't go away or they come in afraid that it will go away.
That's really interesting. Well, and you've used the word normal a couple times, and I'm guessing, you know, we both have fantastically colored hair. So I'm guessing that normal is not something that we ascribe or desire, but I mean, normal sexuality is not a thing, right?
Well, no. So it's not normal. Normal is a mathematical term. It just means usual, common. You know, I mean, that's what we're talking about. And so, you know, there are things that are now considered normal that, you know, 20 years ago weren't, like anal sex. Anal sex isn't seen as very kinky anymore.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But 20 years ago, oh my God, you know?
Right.
So, and people want to be normal because they want to be like the larger group. That's why they're, you know, that's why they're seeking to be normal. They want to fit in. They want to feel okay.
Right.
But actually, in terms of sexuality, all of this are just variations, right? They're just variations. There is nothing out of bounds, abnormal about any of this. They're variations on the norm. The only areas where people really should be concerned, if their desires are to have sex with beings that cannot consent. And I'm not talking about having a rape fantasy that you know is a fantasy, that you would never enact in the world, that you want to do with a partner and you're going to get a bit rough and you're going to have all the safe words. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about persistent desires to rape, abuse, hurt, people who do not want to partake in any of this.
Or can't consent to it, as you said before.
Or can't consent to it. So they don't want to, or they're incapable of consenting. And I said beings because we have to include animals in this as well, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And if those are the desires that you're having, then that's something that needs treatment. And again, we're still not very good at treating that. Like, let's be really clear.
Right.
I mean, we take pedophilia, for example. We're absolutely awful at treating pedophilia, although we have ways of controlling behavior, and they're right. The ways are very severe. The ways are very severe, and they're very severe because pedophiles do intense damage.
Right.
And that we don't have a successful way of treating them so they're no longer pedophiles.
Right.
There are people who are pedophiles who don't act on their urges, but that is a very, very small segment. Very, very small segment. Mm-hmm. And it usually takes great effort. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that they're not inappropriate. It just means that they're not raping, they're not fondling, they're not molesting. It does not mean they're not inappropriate. Mm-hmm. Does not mean they're not violating the boundaries. And so they're actually still causing damage. Mm-hmm. Sexualizing a young child and communicating that right. to a young child is damaging to the young child.
Right.
Period.
Period. Exactly.
And so those are the kinds of things where you're like, yeah, that's something that needs treatment. I do not treat folks who have those sorts of problems. I did do some work way early in my career during internship, but I don't do that anymore because it's just incredibly difficult work because we're not successful.
Right.
Right. And if somebody is determined to take themselves out of existence, that's another time where they need treatment. And that's usually not a sexual urge, although they're getting pleasure out of the actions. The urge to take themselves out of existence usually has to do with other things. And so that's, again, another one. But that's a hard one because, you know, there are a lot of us who play on that edge, that very close edge. So, you know, might do things that other people would be like, what the fuck? Mm-hmm. Like, really? You know what kind of risk you're taking? And so I find it really important to say to people, you know, I'm not going to judge. But what I am going to say to you is you need to risk assess.
Yeah.
And you cannot risk assess if you don't know what the risk is.
Right.
So you need to go do due diligence and get your information and not rely on somebody else to be doing that. Mm-hmm. And then decide if you want to do whatever it is, jump out of an airplane. Or do breath play with a belt.
Right.
Or, you know, all of these things that I now see people do without even thinking about because they think it's normal.
Yeah. Right. Right. And I mean, that's been my experience of being with someone, quote unquote, playing a dom versus somebody who has done some actual research and knows what a scene is instead of, you know, just potentially causing harm.
Well, what's going on now is because of social media. I will tell you that every audience I ask to tell me something that used to be kinky that isn't anymore shouts out choking. Mm. And I say, no, that's still kinky, right? And it's dangerous, and here's why. Mm. And what's frightening to me is that it's been so popularized that people don't even question. They don't even question the risk they're taking.
Right.
That they don't think it through. Young people don't think it through.
Right.
Teenagers are doing this with each other.
Oh, I remember like my friends and I would push on each other's chests until we would pass out. Like,
yeah, not.
What?
Not. I mean, we all do stupid things when we're younger, sometimes when we're older, but I think it's gotten so much more in the popular media that it is really something that, you know, I raise the alarm on all the time. It's like, again, I'm not going to judge you if this is what you think you like, but go find out what the risks are. Mm-hmm. Like things like, first of all, you have to know that it's never safe. Breath play is never safe. There's no way to make it safe. Mm. It's impossible to make it safe. I say it over and over again. I'm like, you're going to get sick of hearing me. You can make it safe, safer, but not safe. Now, I'm not going to judge you if you decide safer is good enough for you because we all make those sorts of decisions. Lots of people don't use any kind of protection when they have oral sex because the chance of transmission of certain diseases is much lower with oral sex. Right. So they decide that they will take that risk because they don't enjoy using a condom or a dental dam with oral sex. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to give them a hard time. They have a right to take the risk. I just want them to know what they're doing when they take the risk. Just understand the risk.
To be mindful.
That's it. Just understand the risk you're taking.
Right.
And with breath play, you really need to know your own body and you need to know if you have any anomalies.
Yeah.
And most of us don't know that.
Until something happens, right.
Until something happens.
Right.
And unfortunately, with breath play, until something happens can be a stroke, a heart attack, or death.
Right.
You know, so it's making sure that you're actually looking at what you're doing, getting the education, and then that you're making a choice, not in the middle of being hyped up and excited.
Right, right.
Not because you saw something that was really cool or you heard somebody talk about something and it makes a great fantasy. Fantasy isn't reality.
Right. Do you have some reputable sources that you send people to regularly when they want to do some more research about some of these kinks that are potentially dangerous?
I mean, some things there's written resources. I mean, for breath play, go do an anatomy. I mean, really, look at anatomy. Look at physiology and then talk to people who are experienced. There's a couple of people, I don't know that Orpheus Black is actually teaching around this anymore because he's been doing some pretty cool spiritual coaching. And so he's been less on the physical ends and more on some of the more psychological and spiritual aspects of things. However, Orpheus Black was a really good one who taught a superb class on breath play. And he is out of Los Angeles. There aren't any other people that I would specifically recommend by name at this point. He was my touchstone, but there are other people. You just have to look at their credentials and vet, right? And, you know, I would talk to somebody who is actually a doctor, lo and behold, or a nurse or a paramedic, right? Somebody who's kinky, or perhaps somebody who isn't, right? Perhaps somebody who isn't, but somebody whose opinion you trust who isn't going to shame you just because you have a desire, who isn't going to tell you that's crazy.
And that's the hard part.
Right.
Finding a doctor who won't shame you.
Right.
There are
kinky doctors. There are plenty of them, you know, so to actually have the conversation, if it's something you really want to do, I mean, do lots and lots of research, comb through places till you find the sources that are going to be the right ones and reassure yourself that you have the information and then recognize that, you know, shit happens.
Right.
You know, it's not just having the information, it's understanding what it is that you're doing. That what you're doing isn't safe. It's not having the la, 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 I'm not listening, this is going to be fine, ears on. It's okay, I'm doing something, it might not be safe. I'm going to do it because it's going to be fun or it's going to be intense or whatever it is, right? But that you understand that that's what you're doing. And with some things, you're playing Russian roulette. And so you should know that that's what you're doing. You're playing Russian roulette.
Well, to totally shift a little bit, because I see we're coming to the end of time, I'm curious how you would answer this question. Would you consider yourself a healer?
Yes. I mean, and I have a spiritual side to me. I mean, I talk about it in my book. And I think that in addition to the cognitive, the psychological, I think the unifying factor for me is the way in which I hold space. And that comes from a healing place. That comes from a healing side. So it's the way in which you create safety in a room to be able to facilitate a process. And that comes from, I mean, it's all one me, but it comes from that part of things for me. But nobody has to believe in any kind of thing at all. And they'll still experience the same thing with me. You know, that's, you hold the space, you hold the space. But people who are aware have said, you know, well, you're healing people. And I'm like, yeah, but I'm not laying on hands. I'm not doing it. It's not.
You're not doing it to.
No, I'm facilitating their ability, not doing it to them.
Yeah.
And I think that's an important distinction because some healers do. Some healers do it to you. They lay hands on or they do a particular practice and they're healing you, whereas I'm actually facilitating you healing yourself.
Yeah. How about wounded healer? How does that strike you?
I don't see myself as wounded anymore. And, you know, I'm a work in progress like everybody else and I'm constantly growing. But I don't see myself as wounded anymore. You know?
Yeah.
And that's, I think if there's any message that I can get across is that you can actually get to a place where that's not what you identify. That's not the thing you want to put forward. You know, I spend a good portion of my time in joy, as much in joy as I can. And just, you know, 40 years ago, totally different situation.
Right.
Right. But I did the work and I'm grateful for the people that really helped me. And then I just continue to do work. So I continue to learn more and more and more. But when the symptoms went I no longer felt wounded.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I hold the term a little differently in that, not that I feel like I'm walking around wounded, but I feel like those wounds shaped me in a way that makes me feel more empowered and makes me feel like I have the capacity to connect with people who do identify as being wounded in any given moment.
I mean, I don't feel like I can't do that connecting. I guess the reason I don't resonate with the term anymore is because for me, that's the same thing as being a survivor,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
So it's that a lot of what I see with people is that the struggle to get from victim to survivor is huge. And
yeah.
so people get there and then that new identity is the one that they stay with. And
yeah.
in part because often they build a whole world around that. They're fighting for change. They're,
right.
you know, they're working with people on it. They're, you know, everything is
right.
surrounding that. And so to let go of that or move past that is scary because they don't know what comes next. And often people don't have tools. That's the other thing I really wanted to make sure that I said. You know, there's the therapy, but there's also skills that people are missing as a result of trauma. People often don't have adequate emotional skills. Like they don't know how to self-soothe. They can't emotionally regulate. They don't set boundaries. They don't communicate well. They don't have a good core sense of self sometimes. They don't have different ways of expressing different emotions
mm-hmm.
or even naming different emotions. And social skills they might not have either. So they might not have the best social skills. So that's a separate piece of work
mm-hmm.
that, I mean, you can still do with the same person if they're willing to do skills work with you, but is often forgotten about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if you don't learn new ways to cope, so lots of people who have PTSD dissociate, so
right.
they're not embodied at all.
Right.
And if you don't teach them how to be embodied and they don't learn that skill, then ultimately they're going to pick back the skill that they had because it's the only one they have. And
right.
so they may not have symptoms from the events that they've experienced, but they're still walking with faulty skills, so they're still attracting the same things
right.
and still getting into the same things and feeling the same type of things.
Right.
So that's an essential bit too.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I'm curious because you said that there were particular types of therapy that you really like for sexual trauma. What are those?
So I do traumatic incident reduction, which is one that you probably won't have heard much about because people haven't spent a lot of time researching it, but it's mm-hmm. really effective. And that can be done spread out over a period of time or intensively. I think intensively, if you're able to afford it and you're willing to do it, is the best way because when you spread things out week to week, life interferes. So you're constantly
yeah.
dealing with current stuff as well.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the key features is there's no fixed session time. So you work on something until it's finished and there is an operationalized definition of finished.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be finished for that day or it might be finished completely, but you don't let somebody leave when they're in floods of tears or when they're still stuck in the past.
Another reason to not do it in a 50-minute session.
Yeah, and I won't do any trauma work in a 50-minute session. Mm. I refuse. Because the 50-minute session is for containing. That's the reason it was there.
Right.
And with this kind of stuff, it doesn't contain. So the
right.
container has to be bigger. There's eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And for some people, that's also really helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the two that I find the most helpful from the talking standpoint. Yes, there are somatic therapies. They're very useful. But in my experience, people actually getting rid of all their symptoms, somatic therapy doesn't do it on its own.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there are trauma somatic therapies. And I don't know the names of the most recent ones, but there's a lot
yeah.
of, because they keep changing.
NARM, SE, SP, yeah.
And so those are great as well. Those are particularly good if you don't have any access to memory or if you were
right.
just barely verbal or pre-verbal when the trauma happened.
Yeah.
Starting with those. Well, what people don't realize is you don't have to remember the words. The words come. And yes, I know that they weren't the words you were thinking when you were four. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. One of the things I teach people when I'm working with them is let's not be literal.
Yeah.
Like what comes up, comes up.
Right.
I'm not asking you to tell me literally what happened.
Mm-hmm.
You might do, but I'm asking what's coming to mind now.
Mm. So the traumatic incident therapy would work for someone who doesn't have a specific memory.
Yeah. Yeah, we work because we can start with a theme of emotions.
Mm.
We can start with emotions. We can start with feelings. We can start with a body feeling. There's all sorts of ways of coming in.
Mm.
And there are a number of different techniques that fall under the same rubric that you can use. So if one way of working isn't working, move to something else.
Right.
I think what's most important is that most of the research demonstrates that there's no way out but through.
Yeah.
So any kind of therapy that allows you to push it back down or push it away.
Yeah.
doesn't work. Any kind of therapy where the therapist is making the interpretation also doesn't tend to work.
Right.
And the expression of emotion can be really important. Not for everybody, but it can be. And in my experience, it often is. So those are the methods that I recommend. I co-authored a book with my first husband on traumatic incident reduction that was for therapists, but it is a really easy read. It's still out there. It is really expensive because John Wiley and Sons have been trying to get it to go out of print for more than 20 years.
Oh my gosh.
So they raise the price every year and it's not out of print.
Wow.
There are libraries that have it and you can usually find secondhand copies of it.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get author's copies. Mm. And for love nor money, I can't seem to do that.
Oh my goodness.
So I still get royalties from this every year, but it's like a, you know, it's like a small amount of royalties that still get. And I do recommend it if you can get it secondhand or if you're willing to spend the money, I will greatly appreciate you. And I often try and find source secondhand copies for people who are going to start working with me who like to read and like to understand. I say, would you rather read about it or we talk about it first? And so they'll say, read about it. I'll say, okay, let me get this to you. You can read about it and then we can answer questions. With eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, there's stuff out there as well.
Yeah.
Make sure if you're going to do that, you actually go to somebody who was trained, I hate to say this, but who was trained under the formal system as opposed to somebody who went and took a rogue course. There are rogue courses.
Yeah.
And so Shapiro is the person who developed that system. So make sure you go see somebody who's trained under that. If you're interested in traumatic incident reduction and you're looking to find a practitioner near you because you want to be face-to-face, I mean, I work online, so it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
I may be able to help with that, but I'm not 100% sure. But if you drop me a line, sometimes I can.
Well, thank you. And I want to respect your time and make sure we end on time. Do you want to tell people how to find you and your memoir too?
Sure. The easiest way to find me is drlauriebethbisbee.com. It's a pretty comprehensive website, including big FAQs at the back. The memoir, the second edition of the memoir is on the website. It's the paperback, not the hardback. It will eventually be on Amazon, but I've got to do the typeset again. I'm also on Instagram at Dr. Bisbee, on X at Dr. Bisbee. TikTok, I'm at Lori Beth UK. And I've got a private members club that's actually started on my website where people can get some access to me to answer questions. And there's a live every month and there is exclusive content and discounts and things that are thrown in the group. It is a paid for group, but it's really an accessible amount of money. And I did that because Facebook groups and things, I need the number of times that things that Facebook actually went in and looked at a post. Yeah. Yeah. Well, because you're talking about sex and relationships.
Right.
So I invested in moving it to my website so that people could have that anonymity and that safety so they don't have to worry about who is going to be looking at what.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being here today. I really appreciate it. And I know you're so busy. So it's just, I'm grateful for your time.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Thanks to our guest for an amazing conversation today. To find out more about today's guest, you can visit www.headheartbiztherapy.com/podcast.
You can find Sarah at Head Heart Biz Therapy on Facebook and Instagram.
And you can find Anne at Spare Room Wellness or spareroomwellness.com.
Thanks as always to Andrea Klunder and the Creative Imposter Studios for editing, to Liam O'Donnell for the album art, and to Ben Mueller for our theme music. Until next time, bye-bye.